So thank you very much for giving the opportunity to present here today about HIV and vaccines and potential treatment strategies. Professor John Fair of Northwestern University, infectious disease specialist and one of the first ones to start treating AIDS patients early in the 80s, keeps on reminding me of one thing. Remember, the planet belongs to the viruses. We are just visitors here. So with 35 million infected individuals, HIV is one of the toughest challenges for our public health systems. 2 million new infections every year, more than 50,000 in US alone. We have worked on a preventive vaccine now for 25 years without any concrete results. The large-scale Thai trial study, although at first reading promising, had much more modest results than expected. So at this point, an effective preventive vaccine seems decades away, and that's been agreed by the field. I will show you in a little bit the scientific rationale for this. So we are now right now searching for alternatives. I'm coming here from Glasgow, Scotland, HIV10 meeting, where there's a huge push for what Julio Montaner from British Columbia has started. It's a trial that he has been carrying in British Columbia for several years now. The International AIDS Society stands behind it. And what they do, they propose a compulsory and universal antiretroviral treatment for all infected as an alternative, because they know that it works. This supposedly would cease the forward transmission on a large scale. In studies in British Columbia, it has been shown already. In my opinion, and that's to be discussed, of course, this would require universal screening, universal testing, universal access to HIV drugs, and universal consulting and monitoring. The cost would run in terms of billions annually. The virus takes the body hostage within the first 40 weeks, if I can show it here. This is where the primary infection takes place. The virus takes over with a huge viremia. The CD4 counts start depleting. We have then the clinical latency, where the lymphoid organs are being seeded, and this will determine what our vaccine strategies are. So here are the different intervention points. We are looking for neutralizing antibodies as a sterilizing immunity. That would be the ideal vaccine, the preventive vaccine that we have been haunting now for 25 years. The problem here is that we would have to have these neutralizing antibodies, who we don't know yet today. We have some indication thereof at NIH, but we don't know where the neutralizing antibodies would be. They would have to be present at very high titers at mucosal tissue, the place where the infection takes place, at the right time of the exposure. Not one single virus should go through, otherwise you will have the hypoviremia. So alternatively, we can think of what we call a therapeutic vaccine, immunotherapy, functional cure. That would be to target for a therapeutic vaccine to activate the immune system to initiate enough T cells to respond in order to control the virus. This is what we would refer to as an immunotherapy. Later on, you will see in the different presentations. The preventive vaccine is still currently very unlikely. So, with therapeutic vaccines, we would be able to control the level of virus so that the infected individual does not, one, progress into AIDS, number two, transmit and spread the disease. In the absence of effective preventive vaccine, our best bet is to control the vaccine and the virus and its spread. I'm not trying to belittle the seriousness of the disease, but I would compare it to the control of herpes simplex. 85% of us carry it with us. We don't spread it. We don't. It's not contagious, and it doesn't destroy our total health. There are about 15 different therapy, vaccine, immunotherapy trials existing, and the goal is to reduce the viral load to the level that we can control it and to preserve the CD4 compartment. I'm done right away.
Okay.
I have one more slide, I think, to cover. So, as we cannot find the holy grail right now, and unfortunately the HIV AIDS research money is all going to preventive vaccine. There's very little money going into this therapeutic vaccine. What we have done, okay, this was not supposed to be here anymore, but it's there anyways. What we have done is exactly what you were referring to. We have taken the beast itself, HIV virus, re-engineered it so it's not infectious, it's not replicating, and we have, as an alternative, applied that to functional cure strategy. Basically, what we have done is we have, in animals, preclinical trials so far, shown a very robust response of undetectable levels of viral load in 40% of the animals. 20% additionally were controlling the virus very well. The immune systems have been very well preserved, no side effects, huge survival benefit. The control group is almost dead already, and the active group is alive. Basically, what is the problem here right now is that we cannot move into phase one trials. FDA has given us, surprise, surprise, approval to go into humans with a lentiviral vector, HIV-based vector, and basically the problem here is that we have to mobilize money from government sources because there are no sources available from philanthropies or private capital markets. So I think, and the next presenters will be showing it to you, therapeutic vaccine is the next step to go before we can move into preventive vaccines, if ever, in 20 or 30 years.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can we take questions? Okay, go ahead. Oh, sure.
Yeah. Give financial disclosure because none of
them. Oh, sure. Go ahead.
My name is Vico Rausala. I am president and CEO of a small company called Viroxys in Gettysburg, Maryland, a privately funded company. Basically, the program that I was presenting is one of our programs, therapeutic vaccine.
And we'll do that. Okay, that's fine. Yeah, we'll do that. I think the point here before we do this is that For public health, for people who work in public health, our intent was to let you know about what the new therapeutics are that are needed for long-term HIV/AIDS survivors whose regimens are actually not working for them now. Now, there's a couple of things, and I thank you for your helping us along in this. These therapeutics, these companies, and there are a lot of small ones, they're approximately 2,900 to 3,000 small biotech companies in the country. Now, not all of them do HIV/AIDS. You know, it can be cardiovascular, immunotherapy, they'll do a lot of things. Most of them started in university environments, where in point of fact, the intellectual capital that they have invested in these therapeutics, whatever they are, actually came from University of Michigan, Illinois, California. It depends. So the universities, these therapies, many of them, were developed in a university research environment. The problem that they're having now is the intellectual capital, the dollars that it takes to get them to a stage to help public health people like yourselves, or researchers for that matter, if they're researchers in the audience, is enormous. The former platform was, yeah, the universities would invest in these therapies. They would hopefully attract some capital, and then we would eventually be bought up by large-scale companies. That is not happening. So what is happening is that the therapies that they've developed are just languishing. So between, I don't think you understand how much it actually costs to go from one clinical trial level to another. So when these firms are all pre-revenue, they're not making money. They're investing money in their intellectual capital to help preserve HIV/AIDS patients who need new therapies. That's where we are. So it was at least our intent to help you be aware of what's going on and to actually co-join the science with the public health portion of this, which I think is enormously important. So, I mean, if you're thinking that this is like, you know, I don't want to mention big pharma, big buy, no. These were small university, largely university-based companies that have developed to a point where they're developing their own therapies, but they can't go from one place to another because, in a sense, they're stuck. So how are we going to get a new generation of these particular therapies to actually help the patients that you're most concerned with? And that's the dialogue that I hope that'll be stimulated here. So, Jeff, can I bring you up? Hopefully I can actually, do this with me. You've had more experience with this one.
Oh, really? All right, which one?
No. And yes, this one, this last one here.
Okay.
And disclose and do whatever you need.
Yep.
Sorry.
That's right.
Question.
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm sorry. See, the way that this was sort of organic, and what happened was the last guy who was in the program.
So just left click to his hands.
Is it here?
Click there.
So the time.
Catch whatever you want.
He gave us that time. So he was actually representing another firm's call. Isn't it Polymedics?
No, it's Tabira.
Sorry about it. Tabira. Sorry. Who's in the same state. So why don't I do this? If you like it, I'll give you a list of them all, and because we don't really have it quite that way.
I just meant this. I think
okay.
It's 2 o'clock. It's 2 o'clock.
Right.
So if we could just know how many people there are, and then just
okay.
Say the
people.
Name and the company.
There's four.
Two more people, and he'll be quick.
Right. So
we actually got them to 2:30.
We have
extra
time, so
that's okay.
If you need to leave, we understand. We have until 2:30. So
okay, I'll be quick. So my company is called Argos, ARGOS Therapeutics. It's in Durham, North Carolina. My name is Jeff Abbey, ABBEY. I'm the CEO. Argos is also one of these small privately funded biotech companies that Rick described. So I think Rico makes a strong case of why we need alternative HIV therapies, but I just want to remind you of why that is. I think we all know that ART has been very effective, but has meaningful limitations. Obviously, some of those are the long-term toxicity, cardiovascular disease, nephrotoxicity, diabetes, etc. Clearly, mortality in ART-treated HIV patients is obviously much higher than in the general population. And of course, compliance is still an issue with some patients. So I think most people, even those who strongly believe in antiretroviral therapy, agree that there are alternatives that are needed. Why we believe in immunotherapy as a promising alternative or a therapeutic vaccine, if you will, I think that there's been a lot of studies, as Rico has hinted at, that show that you can get immune responses in patients. Even those studies that have failed show that you are able to get immune responses, so the immune system of patients can be resuscitated, if you will, to fight the virus. But the strategies that have been tried so far have proved ineffective, and I'll talk about that in a second. The reason that they've been ineffective is that the mutation rate, basically. Every single patient's virus is completely different, and in fact, the virus within that patient is completely different from gene to gene, right? 9 out of 10 genes are different, and they're mutating every single day. So the approaches that have been tried have really been off-the-shelf immunotherapy approaches, trying to use it what's called a consensus of the virus to treat patients. Nobody has the consensus. Everybody, as I said, has a different version of the virus. And that's why we believe they fell. So we believe that you clearly need to have a therapy that addresses the patient's virus, and that's exactly the approach that we're trying. And obviously, you don't want to activate the CD4 compartment, and so that's a key point as well. So what is our approach? So we make a virus from every therapy from every single patient by taking cells from the patient and a viral sample. We take the RNA from the virus, and we use that into what are called dendritic cells, which are then put back into the patient, and then the dendritic cells loaded with the RNA spur T cells, but only CD8 T cells that are activated in order to fight the virus. So what have we seen? We did a phase 1 study, and then we just completed a phase 2 study. The great thing about these approaches, I think everybody agrees, is that they're safe. They're well tolerated. There are no side effects. The only, no serious side effects. The only side effects you get are what you might get when you get a vaccine for the flu. So you get transient flu-like symptoms, go away after 24 hours. You might get some swelling in your lymph nodes. That's it. We've seen stable CD4 T cell counts in all our patients, and we saw a distinct decrease in viral load compared to what viral load was before we treated. So in this study, we took patients who were on antiretroviral, dosed them every 4 weeks, and then took them off antiretrovirals, and then dosed 2 more times. And we had a number of patients who continued without any antiretroviral treatment. Some patients are out over a year now, just without any more dosing. We were only able to dose a couple more times during this booster phase. So we see meaningful clinical responses in patients. And so we've moved to a phase 2B study, which is basically the exact same study. Missing a slide, but that's okay. All right, so we're basically repeating the study with more dosing, but having a control group to show, obviously, versus a control, the impact that we're having. That study actually is funded by the NIH, so we're very fortunate to have NIH funding. But the future for us is really to go into treatment-naive patients and be able to use an immunotherapy in treatment-naive patients and hopefully stop them from ever having to go on antiretroviral drugs, or at least delay it for years, which would be a huge benefit to patients who right now have no alternative but to wait until they go on to the drugs. But as Rico said and Rick said, there's no money to do these studies. Our investors, we have a similar approach in cancer. That's where our money is going from our investors. They don't want to invest in HIV. Big Pharma doesn't want to invest in HIV. So the money has to come from public sources. It's the only way to get these products through the FDA into approval. Thank you very much.
Or else what happens if they don't?
And they don't go further. I mean, you know, if you want to talk about what it costs, a phase 3 study in cancer in 600 patients is going to cost my company around $70 million. And an HIV study probably has to be double that size, maybe, or something. So,
but as a small firm, I guess the point is that, you know, what happens to the intellectual property if you don't get that?
Well, you, I yes, mean, okay. you can't, you, I mean, if right. you can't develop the product anymore, then it doesn't, nothing happens to it, right? I mean,
okay.
That's, right. Okay.
Corey, Joey, much. Somebody. I'm not sure I know how to do this, but okay, I'll give it a shot. Oh, God, how do I actually do this? We're almost done. Okay.
All right, for those of you that are here, I'm basically here to talk about improving clinical nutrition in the area of HIV/AIDS and HART therapy. And basically, there's a lot of different things that you actually have to address, because what goes on in an HIV-infected patient is, especially those that are on heart therapy, is there's a cascading, you know, series of metabolic effects that are degenerative in nature that only end up proceeding further and further as they go along in the treatment. Basically, the 7 key factors, and then some of them even like have sub-factors that affect these patients. One, first and foremost, is chronic inflammation. It's seen, you know, basically with the viral infection, but it's also associated with even more of those deleterious metabolic effects that happen later down the road. You'll also see chronic inflammation in things like type 2 diabetes, obesity, and a lot of other metabolic disturbances as well. Oxidative stress is another key thing that goes on. Basically, the body's not able to use its own antioxidant mechanisms to fight off basically the quickly changing pH that goes on a systemic level. Number three, you have disturbances in not only protein, but lipid and carbohydrate metabolism. Now, that's pretty complicated because it does involve a whole lot of different mechanisms of complex, you know, biochemistry, but basically it makes essentially everything they eat from that point on, you know, essentially worthless. Number four, the transmigration of gut flora, basically the microorganisms that live inside you all the time that are basically there to stimulate your immune system and also there to, you know, help you digest food as well. You end up losing a lot of those, and those are highly responsible for keeping your CD4 lymphocytes actually stimulated the entire time. They do a good job of keeping each other in balance. And we have number five, which is mitochondrial dysfunction and toxicity. You see that with a lot of HAART drugs. Basically, the mitochondria are there because those are the small parts inside of every one of your cells. They're responsible for the nutrient transition into energy. So they're the ones that pretty much keep you running all day long.
Are you saying that the likelihood, when people see actual patient HIV AIDS patients, that the likelihood of having one of these is high? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying the likelihood of having more than one of these is more than 90%. I mean, all these are quite common. Also, you've got malabsorption and malnutrition, and those are things that, you know, mostly you're seeing in people who have muscle wasting, those types of symptoms, but it can also be a side effect of the drugs as well, like nausea and vomiting and diarrhea. That can also cause macronutrient and micronutrient deficiencies, which, you know, also are going to have taxing effects on the body as well. And then also we have catabolism, and as far as that is defined, it's basically the breakdown of larger components of the body to smaller components and then eventually into energy. And that manifests itself as muscle wasting, lipodystrophy or lipoatrophy in that case. And then the last part involving carbohydrate metabolism is ketoacidosis and gluconeogenesis. So basically what's going on is the entire priority of sustaining the actual body's tissues shifts whenever you have a viral infection. For the obvious reason that you actually are being invaded by a pathogen, your body decides, well, it's better yet to, you know, use these nutrients and everything to actually fuel our immune system, to make more T cells, to stimulate more cytokines, to stimulate more immunoglobulins and stuff. And basically use all your resources that you're intaking from your diet and shift it to immunity instead of structural, you know, maintenance. But basically, what types of let's go back to that one. Actually touched on this. Also, the loss of mitochondria in skeletal muscle tissue is a huge thing. Basically, what occurs in these muscle cells is because these mitochondria are lost in such high numbers, for one, their ability to produce energy is highly compromised. In addition to that, you end up having muscle cells actually fusing together as a result of this into becoming like more giant muscle cells just to compensate for this loss of mitochondria. And then on a larger scale, you end up seeing weakness, frailty, and the inability to even exercise and maintain an active lifestyle, which is something that in a lot of therapeutic scenarios is pretty much required by a dietitian or whoever is there actually consulting the patient.
No, I'm gonna have to skip the next one.
Okay. Actually, that's kind of the point, but okay. Lipodystrophy is basically the loss or improper deposition of fat. So whenever you end up taking up, I think this one is NNTRIs, this is proteases that basically cause this. It has two different involvements. One is on the gene that's actually responsible for fat cell differentiation, which is called PPAR gamma. And it also has an activity on mitochondrial replicase as well. But this ends up increasing your risk for cardiovascular disease. A lot of patients become obese. You know, they have high triglycerides and LDL cholesterol. But you end up seeing this exact same type of thing in those three types of demographics. So this is something that goes across to other diseases as well. Now, as far as nutritional therapies that can provide logical solutions to that particular aspect, there's things like omega-3 essential fatty acids. There's been many, many studies already conducted that show the efficacy of EFAs to actually decrease triglycerides in a lot of patients. Another one, acetyl-L-carnitine, is actually there to be responsible for the transport of fats into cells. I touched a little bit on PPARs earlier, but that actually family of genes, the PPARs, are responsible for basically the energy acquisition and maintenance and basically where all your nutrients end up going. Also, phytosterols are really effective for decreasing LDL cholesterol along with coenzyme Q10.
Well, let me ask you a question, since this in essence is a part of the solution to the problem you talked about. When people see patients, when doctors or nurses see patients in the field, what should they be looking for in terms of nutritional diagnoses? Because they're not experts in nutrition.
In this particular case, it shouldn't be so much a matter of nutrition, because you really can't bank on these patients, in a sense, to be responsible regarding their diet and exercise. Instead, you should look for, you know, significant markers in like blood tests, you know, for actual triglyceride and cholesterol levels, how much protein is actually there, look for like blood urea nitrogen, things like that. I mean, you want to look for signs that the body is breaking down in all these different places in order to know what kinds of nutritional therapies to actually prescribe.
Should I skip this, or what do you want me to know?
I'll just touch on this briefly. I do kind of want to go back to the protein one. Gluconeogenesis, this is the reversal of normal sugar metabolism. You see this commonly in diabetics, especially type 2 diabetes. It will also increase your risk for obesity. But basically, this is when your body's tissues are actually broken down. They're converted back into glucose, and then they're actually used for energy in a process called the Cori cycle. Go ahead.
You want me to go forward or back?
Go forward on this. So there's also kinds of therapies that are, you know, well studied. They're actually readily available. You can actually use things like complex carbohydrates instead of simple carbs. Those basically create a longer insulin response for a longer duration of time, which can decrease the likelihood of these patients actually developing insulin resistance. One thing I wanted to touch on was no high fructose corn syrup. There's actually certain products that are available and actually are the common standard of practice in HIV/AIDS that do contain interesting amounts of high fructose corn syrup, and that's actually something that's contributing to the insulin resistance of these patients. Another thing is insulin sensitizing agents or insulinomimetics. Those are fairly new, and there are a few studies on those. And the last thing is ligands for AMP kinase, which is something that has a lot to do with energy and sugar metabolism as well, and then activating PPAR delta. So on a cost-benefit analysis scale, what are we actually looking at, and what do we stand to gain or lose when we consider nutritional therapies? Many clinical studies, like I said earlier, have already taken place, but unfortunately they're not really translated into practice. And I don't know if that's just a lack of awareness or what exactly is responsible for that. It can actually dramatically decrease the cost of healthcare, especially in the long term. If you look at a patient who is on ARVs, which, you know, in the United States already is fairly expensive, if you consider the fact that they might also be on an anabolic steroid or growth hormone regimen in addition to it, if they've got, you know, lots of muscle wasting, that's another thing to consider that also is very, very costly, especially for those who are on Medicaid. So whenever you could possibly introduce this nutraceutical therapy, you can dramatically decrease the cost in both the short term and in the long term. But being that it is so much more effective as far as cost is concerned, it could actually be universally accessible. You can be translatable to PEPFAR, Medicaid, all these other demographics that are hardly ever touched by pharmaceuticals in the first place. And they can work independently, or they can also work synergistically with ARVs or other medications. For the most part, I would look at them as being utilitarian and actually trying to mitigate the side effects of, you know, their actual pharmaceuticals that they're on. And it improves the patient's overall wellness, their positive body image, and nutritional status. But basically, we need more prospective studies to determine therapeutic dose ranges for a lot of these different compounds, especially regarding a lot of ethnobotanical compounds or phytochemicals that are just newly being discovered. And they're still being discovered more and more every day, and they're showing all kinds of different therapeutic applications. Also in a lot of different mushrooms as well. But basically, we also need to actually apply more resources, whether they're from the private sector, whether they're from the government, or from academia, to actually try to get more interest generated into this actual direction.
You didn't identify yourself.
Oh, by the way, I'm Joey Savage. I'm here on behalf of Muscle Farm. We are giving away plenty of free samples out front. If you'd like to, take one on your way out.
Thank you.
But I
got to cut you off.
Okay.
We are.
Can I get a conclusion?
Yeah, okay, good conclusion.
Let's wrap it up.
Okay.
Yep,
no, that was it. Okay, that was it.
Fair enough.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you.
If you hardcore that left. My name is Mike Stevens. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer for one of the two companies who I'm going to be showing you some data that was presented at the Vienna conference. That company's Virostatics. But basically, I want to start out by talking about how we can learn from nature as we try to treat these diseases.
Yeah. Okay. And why do we need to do this? Basically, because we need new therapeutic approaches if we're going to have normal lifespans for people living with HIV and AIDS at this point. The therapies that we have resistance, we have toxicities, we need to have some new approaches. And so let's learn from nature. Let's see how nature handles these things. One of the related viruses to HIV is SIV. This is in monkeys in Africa. It's simian immunodeficiency virus. The city Mangabe has this disease. They have tremendously high viral loads, and their CD4s stay elevated, and they die of something else. They pass it on to their progeny, but they die of something else. So the virus isn't killing them. Their immune system is basically ignoring it. It's deactivating. And so they don't lose CD4 cells like we do. With HIV-1, which is what affects man, this is classical HIV and AIDS, there's very little natural control. There are some people who are very lucky, and they're long-term non-progressors. But by and large, we have to rely on viral suppression by drugs to handle this disease. But there's a related disease, and that's HIV-2. This was the second HIV that was described in Central Africa around Cameroon and through that area. It sometimes has been called a kinder, gentler form. People don't progress as fast. They don't progress as much. There are some very few people who do progress as if they have HIV-1, but they're the minority. And what happens here is the immune system actually mounts a response, a cellular response against the virus. And so if we could take the best of each of these and combine them into a therapy, then we would have something that maybe could last a lifetime for patients. So we want to learn from nature. Well, what we're learning now is that what we first learned about HIV wasn't really the case. We thought that if you were infected with HIV, that HIV directly killed all those CD4 cells. You lost your CD4 cells, you progressed to AIDS and died from an opportunistic infection. What we now know is the case is that there are some other things that are going on, and some of them happen in the first 2 weeks that you're infected, like the loss of all the CD4s that are in your gut, which are our first line of defense. That means that everything that you swallow, everything goes into your tear ducts, every time you put your hand in your mouth, all of these viruses and pathogens are being digested and presented to the immune system, but now the immune system's not there because HIV has wiped out those CD4s within 14 days. So now they're getting exposed to the central immune system. That causes the CD4s to constantly be turning over. They're reproducing at a tremendous rate, and they basically burn out. It's almost like an advanced aging. This is the hyperimmune activation that takes place. Now, with heart therapy, we've got very, very good therapy that can decrease the HIV replication, but you notice it's really not making a big impact on the red lines. And so these other factors that are causing this hyperactivation, which are really fueling HIV pathogenesis, are left largely untouched by heart. So the field is now developing drugs and biologics that can incorporate these recent learnings. And one group that has emerged are called AV-HALTs. Now, I know we don't need another acronym in HIV. We've got HART and we've got all these things. But AV-HALT stands for Antiviral Hyperactivation Limiting Therapeutics. These are drugs that accomplish two things. First is they're antiviral, just like the 30 plus drugs and combinations that we currently have. They will reduce the viral load. But they do something else. They tune down this over-rambunctious immune response that is burning through the CD4 cells and causing the progression to AIDS. So they're actually protecting the immune system. Two components, AV and HALT. The HALT component we accomplish by using drugs that basically can cool off this hyperproliferation that's taking place. So we're actually addressing a human enzyme, not a viral one. The problem we have with HIV is it's so sloppy, it makes so many copies of itself, that some of those copies find their way around the drugs that we currently have. Here we're talking about drugs that affect a human enzyme. And most of us don't walk around mutating every day. And so when you have a drug that's going to have an effect, it's expected that that effect is going to be prolonged and durable. The other area that you heard about today was therapeutic vaccines. And just very briefly, they're given to those who are already infected.
And what they're really doing is they're teaching the immune system to go out and seek and destroy HIV-infected cells. So when a cell has markers on it saying, I'm HIV-infected, these vaccines tell the immune system, okay, get rid of that guy. And so that's what they're doing. Fewer infected cells then mean that there will be less virus produced. We do this by generating a cellular response heavy on the CD8, the natural killer cells, some CD4 responses, but basically, we're not producing antibodies. We're teaching these cells to go out and kill the bad cells. They have the potential to be used very early in HIV disease. They could be used from the very, very beginning. And they can be used throughout therapy to obtain a maximum immune response. When you're resistant to the other drugs, this is a separate mechanism. So a very quick scorecard, looking at lowering viral load, HART does it very, very well. AV HALTS does it very well. And therapeutic vaccines also need to lower viral load. And this is very important if these are ever going to get out to the people who need them, because the FDA in the US, the EMA in Europe, and other regulatory authorities only accept viral load as the rationale for a drug being approved. It can't be increased CD4 cells, it can't be delaying HART. It can't be some of the very things that we think these therapies will do. They have to be able to lower the viral load. Increasing CD4 cells happens with the HALT, the HART, and to some extent with the therapeutic vaccines, although they're really good at maintaining a robust CD4 situation. Limiting hyperactivation, HART does it to some extent, especially if there's a protease involved, but not to the extent that the AV HALTs, because they're specifically designed to lower this. And then finally, boosting the HIV-specific immune responses. HART actually works the opposite way. When you have somebody that's controlled on HART, their HIV-specific immune responses actually decrease because there's no antigen around to fuel it. So the therapeutic vaccines do this. So you can think of it as a triangle of what we're trying to do. We've got virus suppression from the drugs. We want to limit the immune activation so that we can maintain those CD4 cells, and we want to boost the immune system. AV HALTs accomplish two things. They limit this activation, they cause viral suppression, and the therapeutic vaccines, by immune boosting, also decrease the virus suppression. So very quickly, I want to show you some of the data that was recently presented on the first AV HALT, a drug called VS-411. It provided direct reduction of both viral replication and the excessive immune activation that drives progression to AIDS. It's a two-drug combination. For those of you who know, it's didanosine or DDI plus hydroxyurea. It's a combination that's been used for a long time. And indeed, this combination lowered HIV viral load by about 1.5 logs, or about 98%. And that's equivalent to what many of the nucleosides will do, the more potent nucleosides. But it also lowered the immune activation in only 28 days to levels that are normally seen at 2+ years of maximally suppressive HIV therapy. So just very quickly, this is the schema. Half doses of DDI, full doses of DDI, various doses of hydroxyurea. It was done in 4 countries by people like Eli Cantabira, who's the new president of the International AIDS Society, Pedro Kahn, an ex-president. And the reason why these 4 countries were chosen is because the researchers wanted to duplicate the global pandemic and were shooting for 50% female, 50% black in the population. And what it showed was that in 28 days, so this is a phase 2 trial, just 28 days, it safely lowered HIV replication using the half dose of DDI, safely increased CD4 cells by 135 cells, and it reduced the markers of this hyperactive immune system. There are 4 of them that we look at. These are for proliferation, exhaustion of the immune system, things like that. And just very briefly, just look at everything that's green. These are the reductions in these parameters that were accomplished at 28 days. What's important about this is that it was accomplished without maximum viral load suppression. These patients still had measurable virus. Only 2 out of the 60 or so patients were less than 50. And so the HALT component was what we were looking at. They did not produce immunosuppression. They did not select for drug resistance. And indeed, it was exactly 50% female and 50% black, 8% Hispanic in this small study. The second one that I want to introduce you to very quickly is a therapeutic vaccine called Dermavir. It's the first topically applied. So this is actually given via a patch applied to the skin. It's put on the skin, you leave it on for 3 hours, and then you throw it away. You do this every 6 to 12 weeks, and that's your vaccine that you're taking. It can be used with or without the current drugs. And in a study that was presented at the Vienna conference, the application of the Dermavir vaccine reduced viral load by about half a log, or roughly 70%, which is equivalent to what D4T or AZT do on their own. So it has a drug-like potency as a therapeutic vaccine. But it's given topically. It's given on this patch. This patch is basically the size of my pocket here. And the vaccine is placed under the patch. It's left there for 3 hours, and then the patch is thrown away, and you come back 6 weeks, 12 weeks later. So what it is a plasma DNA. So this is DNA that codes for HIV, but has some very significant differences to it. It's based on clade, so there's actually a number of these vaccines, a number of dermavirs for clade B, clade C, the mixed clades. But all the structural and regulatory proteins are coded. So it actually makes HIV, but it's non-infectious, and it can't replicate. The integrase is totally destroyed. Reverse transcription doesn't work, NEF is truncated. But what it does is, up here, these are naturally occurring virions. It might be hard to see, but you know, you've got the outer shell, and then you've got the nucleus inside, the capsid that contains the material. The bottom one is the virus that is created by this vaccine. So actually, in the dendritic cells itself, it creates the virus. It's a nanomedicine that is placed inside of this shell. It has nanos sticking out. This looks like a pathogen. It looks like a bug. It's the same size as a bug. The immune system is going to treat this as a bug. It's going to treat it as if it were a virus itself. It's put on the skin, and then you have these Langerhans cells who are going to come up. They're going to grab this, and they're going to take it to the lymph nodes, and they're going to train the dendritic cells because they become dendritic cells themselves once they've captured a pathogen. And basically, we get a Th1 type immune response within the lymph nodes themselves. So here's how it works. This is the skin. You've got this hard layer out, the stratum corneum, which is what you see when you look at anyone. But below it, you've got several different layers, and these are the Langerhans cells. And there's about 500 to 1,000 of them in every cubic millimeter or square millimeter. And their job is, if there anything happens out here in the external environment, they come up and see what's going on. So we basically take the patient to the spa, we use a sponge and do an exfoliation. We use a strip to strip off the dead cells, and that causes a danger signal, and so these guys all come up to see what's going on. We put the patch over the area that we've just worked on, we inject we just put the vaccine in there, and now these guys are going to come up and grab a hold of that. And when they do, they then take it to the lymph node where they create the little faux HIV and cause the HIV response that goes body-wide. This was looked at in patients who were naive to therapy. It boosted the memory. You know, there were no adverse events. And this is the 0.4 milligram dose, which is the dose that the company is going to take further. You can see the half-log reduction that occurred. So they received the vaccine 4 times for 3 hours each time. And then at 24 weeks, there was a half-log reduction.
Okay. Thank you. We got to wrap up.
I know. I'm just wondering why it's doing that.
Well, okay, Mike. That's it. Thank you. Do we have any questions, I guess, is my point. I got to. Were there any questions? We really do thank you all for staying. I know it's been a long conference for everyone, and we do hope to connect the science to the public policy and the public health portion of this, and hopefully, and I mean it really, that some of the firms that are producing the new therapies will be around next year to talk about it. It's kind of like that. These are not large pharma. These are not large bios. And my fear is really that the long-term HIV/AIDS patient population that needs the new therapies will not get them. Thank you.